It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Scott LaMontagne. He's a senior technical officer for human papillomavirus and inactivated polio vaccines at PATH. And PATH is an international NGO, which stands for Program for Appropriate Technology in Health. For the previous 5 years, Dr. LaMontagne was the research manager for PATH's HPV vaccine demonstration projects, which have vaccinated more than 65,000 girls in India, Peru, Uganda, and Vietnam. He is an expert in HPV vaccination planning, implementation, and evaluation in developing countries. He serves as a member of the Gavi Alliance and the HPV subteam and holds an affiliate professor position in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington. Prior to PATH, Scott was a lead team scientist and member of the executive management team for the National Chlamydia Screening Program in England. Dr. Montagne's career has focused on bridging the gap between research and policy by focusing on evidence-based decision-making and program implementation. He has over 17 years of experience in infectious disease surveillance, operations, and implementation research. Also, public health program implementation, monitoring and evaluation, and program management for governments and non-governmental agencies at the local, state, and national levels in resource-poor countries. Dr. LaMontagne has a PhD from Middlesex University in London and a Master of Public Health degree from Yale University and a Bachelor of Arts degree in Japanese Studies from the University of Washington. He does speak Japanese, so you may ask your questions in Japanese during this lecture, and he might help translate for the rest of us. I was fortunate to meet Scott at a global health conference long ago in Washington, D.C., and since then, I've been viewing his talks at several international HPV conferences. He is on the organizing committee for the upcoming HPV conference in Seattle, which is coming in August, and I'll give a shameless plug if you're interested in HPV, be there or be square. Today, Dr. LaMontagne will be speaking about HPV vaccine implementation in developing countries. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Scott LaMontagne to UCI.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. Let's try that again. Good afternoon. So that's what we do in Europe. You have to do it that way. I don't know why they do it, but they just do it that way. So I'm pleased to be here today to talk a little bit about HPV vaccine. And just to get a bit of a barometer before I start, do people know what that stands for? Yes, no, yes, no, most people. Human papillomavirus vaccine. And I'll talk about what that is and how it's being implemented around the world in today's lecture. I'm going to go through the slides first and then take questions at the end, because I think sometimes some slides might preempt questions that will come on in later slides. So if you have a question, just kind of keep a note to yourself and we'll take it at the end. But you might find that it might get answered along the way. I hope it does. So a little bit about PATH. For people that might not know the international NGO community, there's a lot of global health NGOs that do service delivery and programming in developing countries. PATH is one of those. We largely focus on health technologies and using health technologies to improve different conditions, human morbidity and mortality prevention mainly. Our portfolio is quite broad, HIV, tuberculosis, reproductive health, family planning, etc. But for the most part, for the last about 15 years or so, we've been really focused on vaccine work. We do all sorts of vaccine work. It takes a whole huge clinical pathway to develop a vaccine, all the way from preclinical proof of concept studies, all the way up to national implementation of a new vaccine in a country. And so we've been involved in a number of different vaccines along that entire course. Right now, our main portfolio is obviously HPV vaccine, which is what I'm here to talk to you about, but also Japanese encephalitis, rotavirus vaccine, pneumococcal vaccine, influenza vaccine, RSV vaccine, amongst other new candidates for enteric diseases. So today I want to view just a little bit the landscape related to cervical cancer so you have a baseline scientific understanding of what cervical cancer is, what causes it, and then talk a bit about the vaccines so that you know what they are, what people need to consider when they're introducing the vaccine, just as a baseline so they're all of a common understanding of just the framework. Why is it important to do this? And then the vast majority of my remarks are going to focus specifically on implementing these vaccines in developing countries. I'm mainly going to be citing the peer-reviewed literature on vaccine experience from a number of different countries to give you a grounding in the evidence base for the implementation, talk a bit about what works well, talk a little bit also about what doesn't work well, and hopefully we can see how those lessons can be applied in new programs coming up. So a little bit about cervical cancer. Does anybody know anybody that's had cervical cancer? Okay, a few of you. How many people get regular pap smear screenings? A few of you. Now, do you know your pap smear is testing for precancer? People know that? Okay, good, good. So cervical cancer is actually a pretty big problem. We don't hear so much about it as we hear about breast cancer in this country, largely because the incidence in the United States is quite low, as shown on this slide. These green colors here are countries that have pretty low rates of cervical cancer. And the red ones are countries that have enormously high rates of cervical cancer. So basically, outside of the developed world, cervical cancer is a big problem. And in fact, it's a leading cause of morbidity and mortality in most countries. For some countries, it's actually the number one cause of death in adult women. So more than HIV, more than accidents, more than other cancers, cervical cancer is killing women worldwide. These latest statistics are from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. About 250,000 deaths every year happen. And on top of that, another 500,000 new cases are diagnosed each year. And if we do nothing, absolutely nothing, that will increase by 50% in just the next 15 years. So it's really a significant problem in countries that have the lowest amount of resources to deal with it. A little bit now about how cervical cancer starts. Does anybody know the cause of cervical cancer? What causes cervical cancer? One person. Well, you don't count, though, because you've been doing research on this for a while. Cervical cancer is caused by a virus, the human papillomavirus, which is why we have human papillomavirus vaccine. And in fact, it is the cause of cervical cancer. If you never get infected with human papillomavirus that are oncogenic, you will never get cervical cancer. The problem is everybody gets infected with human papillomavirus at some point in their life. It's like the common cold of sex. Think of it that way. If you're in this room here today, and let's say your neighbor has a cold, sneezing, spreading germs all over the place, you might get it, but you might not. Because your body is going to try to fight it, right? You build up antibodies to fight the infection that you're exposed to. So the same thing happens with HPV when you're exposed to this virus. Like other viruses, your body mounts an immune response to help fight off the infection. That's the first stage here. So you get infected usually shortly after sexual debut because it's like the cold. Everybody's got it, so they're just giving it back and forth. But unlike the cold, a lot of people clear it. Actually, most people clear it. In fact, about 90% of us will clear the infection just fine. And it goes away, no harm done. But you could get exposed repeatedly over the course of your sexual life. And at some point, maybe, some of those infections would take hold. And that's what happens in this stage, where you get like a persistent infection that your body is not taking care of very well with its natural immune response. That persistent infection actually goes on to develop some signals, precancerous lesions. This is what a pap smear is detecting. It detects precancerous lesions on the surface of your cervix, and that lesion is caused by human papillomavirus. Easily treatable. Most people regress, get rid of these lesions on their own. Some people progress and they become more virulent. You have to go in and get more therapies, etc. But it's treatable. It's preventable and treatable. If these don't get taken care of, there's this proportion of them that'll develop cancer. What's unique about HPV virus, though, is there's lots of them, but only a few, about 13 or 15, depending on which study you read, are oncogenic, meaning they cause cancer. And different types of these oncogenic strains are more progressive or more virulent than others. Just like in the cold, there's different kind of cold viruses out there. And some cold viruses seem to just affect everybody. Everybody gets it. No matter how hard you try to sort of fight it off, right? And other colds are benign, and they don't really progress very much. This virus works very much that same way. There's two specific types. I'll give you some numbers, because they'll come up later. 16 and 18. All the human papillomaviruses are numbered, one through whatever, however many they keep finding. And 16 and 18 are the most virulent types. In fact, 16 is the most virulent type. So if you get infected with it, it is more likely to progress if it's not treated than, say, 31 or 33 or 41 and these other oncogenic types. And that's where you get this vast majority of cancer. So we've talked about prevention just a little bit in terms of your pap smear. This is why it's controlled quite well in the United States and other developed countries, because we invest the money and have the resources to invest to do these screenings. You go in and get your annual pap smear, right? My sisters go on their birthday as a reminder to go and get their pap smear. I don't think that's a pleasant birthday present, but whatever it takes to keep you reminded to go to the doctors and get your annual checkup. But doing something like this in a population of millions of people costs a lot of money, and you need a huge infrastructure and setup in order to do that. Well, most other countries that don't have the resources that the U.S. has just don't have the money to be able to afford something like that. So it's almost impossible, and it's rarely effective, to set up this kind of a system in a low resource or a developing country. So most women will go through their lives, they'll clear, some might progress, some might have lesions, and then they'll go on to cancer. But because none of this screening activity is happening, that's why they have very high rates of cancer, because it's not being detected, therefore it's not being treated. So that's the biggest difference between what's going on in developed countries versus what's going on in developing countries. Where the vaccine comes into play is it actually prevents the infection from taking hold in the first place. So if you've been vaccinated and you're exposed to the virus later on, you actually won't contract it, because your body is going to mount an immune response that fights against it in a very effective way. Like, really effective. These are really, really good vaccines. Compared to some other vaccines that we get, these are phenomenally effective vaccines. So vaccination is being considered as a primary prevention strategy that low-resource settings actually can do something about, in part because they already do a lot of vaccinations for lots of other diseases with infants. And they can do that because there's money for it. In developing countries, since the mid-70s or so, a lot of money has been invested in building this capacity of a country to prevent infectious diseases through vaccinations. Things like, let's see, how many people got measles vaccine when they were in high school? Usually people get that, yeah? Measles vaccine. So they'll do like measles vaccine implementation, or they'll do vaccinations for tuberculosis. We don't do that vaccine in the U.S. because we have very low rates of TB. Or they'll do diphtheria or whooping cough. Or what other common vaccines they would implement there for babies. Chickenpox, not necessarily for babies, but for older infants, they do chickenpox vaccines, etc. So there's a lot of vaccines out there, and there's this platform that's been built already for these countries to use to deliver those vaccines. And there's money. So now we have a new vaccine on the market. We already have a platform that's funded. So people are thinking maybe there's an opportunity to prevent cervical cancer through vaccination instead of screening, because we don't have any money for screening, but we have this multiple resources for vaccinations. So that's kind of the basic framework and idea. And they're not very expensive, actually. Well, depends on where you live. These vaccines, you probably heard it in the press a lot when they were released in the United States on the commercial market, were almost $150 a dose, which ends up being almost $500 for the three-dose course, which is what you need for the vaccine to be pretty effective. Well, it's what we think you need for the vaccine to be pretty effective. And so that can be quite expensive. Most of these places where I work, $500 is the annual salary of people, like a full year's wages for people. And out of that full year's wages, they have to buy their food and their life necessities for the entire year with that $500. Well, they can't save up that money and vaccinate one child for that. So these financing mechanisms get put into place to help support countries buy vaccine on the cheap, if you will. And that's what's happened. Whoops. These last 5 years, 6 years or so, we've seen this dramatic reduction in the price of vaccine available to to low-income countries, it's down to less than $5 a dose. And this is actually not the price the country will pay. This is the price that somebody else is buying the vaccine for them, and then they'll turn around and sell it to another country for about 20 cents. Well, that's affordable, right? That's a pretty low price, just 20 cents for a dose as opposed to what we pay here, $100 to $130 a dose, quite a big differential. But with good reason, they don't have the kind of resources we have, so we shouldn't expect them to be able to mount the kind of financial resources necessary to pay for the vaccine. A little bit of vaccine 101. Has anybody worked in the field of vaccinology before, besides the one professor in the front? Anybody been exposed to that? Okay. So for HPV vaccine, you may or may not know this, there are actually two. I think what you hear about here in the United States most is Gardasil. Have people heard that name before, Gardasil vaccine? So that's made by Merck. It has four different HPV types in it, so it protects against four of those different HPVs. Two of them are oncogenic, 16 and 18, and two of them are not, 6 and 11, which cause genital warts, which is really kind of nasty, but you don't die from it. I mean, it's nasty, but you don't die. I mean, it causes a lot of morbidity, but not a lot of mortality. Then there's a bivalent vaccine, meaning it only has two of these little HPV viruses in it, and that's called Cervarix, and it's produced by GSK or GlaxoSmithKline. And those two vaccines are on the market and have been on the market in the United States. One was in 2006, the other in 2008, so they're quite available. They work by preventing infections, as I said, and the prevention happens, and what we now know is it's been ongoing now for, there's 10 years of follow-up on people, so it's a highly effective vaccine that lasts a long time, and people think it's going to last your whole life. They're very safe. They're very strong in terms of the immune response they help you build up when you get exposed. So they're quite powerful vaccines that a lot of people are looking to be a great benefit for the prevention of cervical cancer. Now, new research has happened about these vaccines to answer the question whether or not you need all three doses. There's a lot of research suggesting that maybe two doses is enough. So that could, if you're spending $100 each, or even if you're spending 20 cents each, it could be some cost savings there. We do expect them to be lifelong. All the data are pointing in that direction. And the recommended population, which is not necessarily who gets vaccinated in the US, but the recommended population is girls aged 9 to 13. And the main reason why that age group is recommended is vaccines, most vaccines, work to prevent you from getting infected. They don't cure you after you've been infected already. So like if there's a measles outbreak in the high school, the reason why they then ask everybody to get measles vaccine is so that you are protected before you get exposed to the measles that's in circulation from that outbreak in the school. So these vaccines are recommended 9 to 13 because we think by those are the ages where you're not likely to be exposed to the virus. And as I mentioned, this virus is sexually transmitted. So the assumption is you're not having sex before the age of 13, which on the whole is true. Like 99.9% of the population globally is not having sex before the age of 13. So that's a reasonable age group to target for the vaccinations, and that's why they're recommended. Lots of people think it's a good idea, and it's endorsed by all the major international agencies, and it's financed for developing countries by an organization called the Gavi Alliance, and they provide it for 20 cents for countries. So countries can apply to them for vaccine supply, and they only have to pay 20 cents. But it's different. It's very different than the other vaccines that these countries are using. When you're born as an infant in, say, Senegal, you'll get a dose of hepatitis B vaccine at birth, and then you'll get other infant vaccinations until 9 months of age, and then you won't get any more vaccinations. The programs that have been set up in these developing countries have largely targeted infant mortality reduction, so getting rid of infectious diseases in the early years of life so that you have a chance of surviving the rest of your adult life. And they've been very powerful for that. We see successes in the eradication of smallpox through vaccination, and now soon the eradication of poliovirus through vaccination. So there are good global public health reasons why to keep the vaccines down in the infant age group. But this vaccine is not being administered at infants. It has to be administered to girls aged 9 to 13. So a lot of people think, well, Can you find those girls? How do you find those girls? Will it be problematic for parents to vaccinate children of that age? Will they have resistance because it's a sexually transmitted infection? Will they vaccinate against cancer? Because cancer's way down there and the girl is still just this young child. And the disconnect between those two things. So all of these questions were sort of circulating in the scientific and public health communities in the mid-2000s before the vaccine was licensed. And people wondered, would it work? So their basic questions are these. Can you get the population? Can you get parents to say yes, which is a big deal? Where would you deliver this? Would you go out to the schools, which is sometimes you have? Some of you probably went to a high school that had a clinic inside the school. You could go there and get your vaccinations. Or do you have to have people come to the hospital or to the clinic to get them? And will it be affordable? These are the kinds of questions we're going to try to answer by implementing vaccinations in developing countries, because these are the key concerns to make sure that it can work for those areas. So there's lots of vaccination going on. It's not just the U.S. A lot of people think that it's new and nobody's using it and it's very expensive, etc. But in fact, there's more than 50 countries worldwide that have introduced this vaccine into their national immunization program. So a lot of people are using the vaccine, and not just them. There's developing countries that have also used the vaccine, just not on a big scale. They've done these things called pilots or demonstration programs, where they try to vaccinate a few hundred or a few thousand girls to get some experience, to try to answer those questions that I had mentioned earlier. How do you find them? Will mother say yes, etc.? So there's lots of countries, even in sub-Saharan Africa, that are sort of trying it out and seeing what happens. And more have ongoing programs that have been starting this last year. We've been working a lot with Zambia, who just finished vaccinating almost 40,000 girls in Lusaka, which is the capital of Zambia, with all three doses of vaccine, to see what mechanisms would work for Zambia to try to make the implementation easier, make it more acceptable to parents, etc. So there's the global experience is quite prevalent. And these countries here, if you recall that cervical cancer map I showed at the beginning, these are the same countries where cervical cancer is a big problem. So now we have a nice match. The prevention strategy is matching where the morbidity and the mortality of the disease is. So let's talk a little bit about these countries. I'm going to delve into some detail from the published literature about what the experience has been from these countries. And there's about 13 or 14 countries or so that are represented in this literature. We worked in India, Peru, Uganda, and Vietnam. We did vaccination programs for about 4 years. And so a lot of the published literature has come from that work. But there's also been interesting work done in Tanzania, South Africa, a couple of the Southeast Asian countries, Bhutan, Nepal, Laos is now vaccinating. So we're going to draw on this from the published literature and look at some lessons learned. It's important to understand how these vaccination programs are designed, though, to understand whether or not they're going to work or not work. What we did in our program was to take an entire neighborhood or entire town or actually groups of villages, all the entire area, and we said, any girl in this entire area who's 10 years old, we want to try to vaccinate. And how that's done is it's done by the national government, who organizes centrally the vaccine supply and then distributes it down to those villages. And they have local health workers that then find these girls in various ways. So by getting a whole community, and no matter where they're located in that area, that's called a population-based program, meaning we're trying to reach the entire population within that area. So that's the kind of program we ran, and it was run by the government. The other kind of program is like a small pilot or a donation program. And what these tended to be is a country or usually an NGO, actually, would ask the manufacturers of the vaccine, either GSK or Merck, can I have a small supply of vaccine so that I can see how I can reach these girls or their parents, because they're never going to get the opportunity. My government will never introduce this vaccine, but I at least want to save some girls from the future pain of cervical cancer. So these donation programs are really based on like an individual benefit sort of approach. We want this one person to get the vaccine because they otherwise wouldn't get it. So structurally quite different. And then we had a couple of countries, Tanzania and Nepal being two, that went on a completely different pathway. Tanzania ran an actual randomized controlled trial, which is a sort of a research paradigm. It's not like a public health program. It's not like clinical service delivery in a for an individual benefit. It's quite different. And Nepal actually had an NGO in Australia import vaccine into Nepal and then distribute it in clinics that their NGO ran in that country. So quite a different model. Oh, NGO, sorry. Yeah, non-governmental organization. What an NGO usually does, there tend to be service delivery organizations in developing countries, and they can do a whole host of different interventions in community. Water and sanitation, vaccinations, but mainly clinical services that are mainly delivered on an individual basis. They're not so, some of them are, like CARE is a good example of that. Huge, absolutely humongous international NGO. They really do crisis relief. They're big. Focus of effort is those really distressed populations, refugee camps, for example, that don't have any clinical care whatsoever. They'll run the medical operations for those for that location. So these are the kinds of pilots that have been done. There's a mixed bag here in terms of whether they're government-run or NGO-run, how many girls are involved, where the vaccination's happening. You can see there's a lot of school-based vaccinations going on. And why that is contrary to what you might hear in the American press. Girls in developing countries go to school, and they go to school in droves. The education attendance rates in most of these countries are on par now with what it is in Europe and the US and Australia. 90-95% of young girls up to a certain age are attending primary school now in these countries. So a lot of people that are implementing the vaccination, because it's 9 to 13-year-olds, 9 to 13-year-olds are attending school, we can probably find them there. So they're sending the nurses out to the school to vaccinate, and largely 9 to 13-year-olds. So I'm going to give you some images of what it's like to do vaccinations in developing countries. Has anybody worked in a medical clinic before? Some people have worked in medical. Have anybody traveled in like a developing country and like out in the bush and really sort of seen, gotten down with the peeps? It's rough, right? It's a pretty constrained environment. And if you're not familiar with that, it can be quite challenging to work in. So I want to show you some images of how the implementation has to happen, because it is really systematic. And what I mean by that is whether you go to Cambodia or India or Ghana or Zambia or Peru, it runs the same way. It's surprising that vaccination programs across these countries are quite uniformly organized. So there's a definite sequence of events that happens. So first you have to train all the health workers. You've got to get them the skills and the knowledge that they need to be able to do the job. That training is pretty routine. They get training all the time. They're used to it when they do other new vaccines. So this sort of mechanism of starting out a vaccination program is quite common. They're used to doing it. They have funds to do it. And then they do some detailed planning. They call it micro planning. Why is that different than macro planning? Because it's down at the village level. So what's happening there is the health workers in that village are coordinating quite closely with the people in the village how they're going to do the vaccination exercise. And everybody is doing that. I mean, I've been to a lot of countries, and they're all doing that process, and they all do it the same way, to make sure that they have the resources where they need to be at the time they need to be. Then you have to do this process called sensitization. It's kind of a foreign word for us. We don't really use that. What we tend to call it is community education. So you kind of raise awareness of what's going on, like a health promotion campaign. You probably see billboards on the bus for, like, anti-smoking campaigns, or use a condom, those kinds of things. Those broad community public health messages, they call sensitization in these programs. So what you do is you go out to the community and let them know, vaccine's coming, the health worker's coming to your school, this is the kind of population, or these are the girls that we're going to vaccinate. If you don't want your child to be vaccinated, don't show up. But if you're there, you will get vaccinated. So what that means is there's no written consent from parents for the vaccine to be implemented. What they do is what they call community consenting. They let everybody know the vaccinations are happening. And if you want them, if you're there, you're going to get them. And if you don't want them, you don't be there. So stay away from school that day. And in fact, some of you might be old enough to remember this. Some of you in the front might be old enough to remember this. It used to happen this way in the United States. I remember in seventh grade, we got a note. The vaccinators are coming to give everybody a booster vaccination. And it'll be going to be on this day. And if you don't want your child to have it, stay home from school. But if you're at school, the public health nurses will be there, and every single person is going to line up in the gym and get vaccinated. And that's exactly what happened. We all lined up in the gym, just went down the line, like 3-4 seconds each kid. Jab, 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 jab. It used to happen that way here. It doesn't anymore. There's no written consent. If you showed up, you're tacitly giving consent. And that's what happens in developing countries. Then you've got to get the vaccine out to the community. You've got to do a big splashy launch. These are actually quite important. You get those sort of like village leaders or people of respect, that people respect in the community, quite visible out there and helping everybody sort of trust the program because they say it's good for them. So it's important to do a launch. Then you've got to vaccinate all these girls, and then you've got to clean up afterwards, dispose of the waste. So what happens then? Can you do it? Can you actually find these people working out there in the bush? Well, here's just a few examples. Yeah, you can. We've got some small places. You know, there's a couple of thousand here, 10,000 here, 40,000 here. But look at how many people are getting vaccinated. You don't see these numbers in California or Georgia or even where I'm from, Washington State. We do not vaccinate 80% of 9 to 13-year-olds, 96%, 97%. It's just not happening here. Why is that? Well, we're going to talk about that. And then if you do population-based surveys, which is what we did, the numbers kind of match. About 80% are getting vaccinated. There are a few hiccups here. These programs in Peru, this one didn't work very well at all. This one in Uganda didn't work very well either. They vaccinated a lot of people. They just vaccinated the wrong people. So that's sort of a problem when you're trying to reach one group and then you get somebody else. But for the most part, these programs have been quite successful, and these school-based ones have been the most successful out of any of them because girls are going to school. And in fact, in Uganda, we actually did a survey in the community. We asked every single person that was supposed to be vaccinated whether they were attending school. Three. Over 2 years, we vaccinated almost 8,000 girls. Three did not go to school. So they're going to school. You can find them there. So what about the parents? What do they think? Most of the research, if you delve into the research, that's done on vaccine acceptability for this vaccine is often done before the vaccine is available. So this is just like, if I offered this to you, would you say yes? So there's lots of studies. There's hundreds of studies that answer that question. But what you don't find a lot of is after they've been offered the vaccine, did they say yes? And why? Why did parents say yes? So we've done a little bit of research in this regard. That was me in Peru, actually, in the jungle. So what did they say? Well, gosh, vaccines are kind of good for us. They're good because they actually see the benefit of vaccination quite immediately with the infant vaccinations. These are communities that are struggling to control infectious diseases. So if they see a vaccine come in, they have cases of polio, for example. They see a vaccine come in and actually prevent future cases of polio. There's a real tangible benefit that people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. Our experience with vaccinations isn't so much that, really. Because most of the diseases that we're getting vaccinated against, they're kept under control. How many people of you know have diphtheria? Probably nobody, right? Because everybody's getting vaccinated for it. So you don't really see that infection anymore in the community. But these areas, they do still see it. So what parents said to us is, I really trust the vaccination program, and I think vaccines are a good idea. Good for public health. So this whole anti-vaccine movement that you sort of see stirred up in many parts of the U.S., you really don't see that there because the tangible benefits of vaccinations are still very real. What else did parents say? Well, they say, I need to make sure that people that I trust think this is a good idea. So they talk to other people. They want to make sure it's kind of like copacetic. It's like, yes, this is real. It's safe. It's fine. Your daughter will benefit. But they need a leader or somebody that they trust to tell them that message. They also, what's interesting is this issue here around being able to get the information and have it understood. This is really about the questions that they have. They want to make sure that their concerns are directly addressed. So if you tell them that, what information do you need to make a decision, and you give them that information, they're more likely to say yes. Some things don't work very well. Here's a few of them. If you don't explain safety and side effects, it's kind of parents are going to say no. They're kind of fearful, right? I mean, like anybody, they want their child to have the best health benefit possible, but they don't want the intervention to do harm. And there are some vaccines that do cause disease. Vaccines that are used, live virus, for example, there's a small risk that you actually couldn't develop the disease from the vaccine. So, and that happens, and so you have to be careful in your messaging about safety and side effects. These data from before about asking parents, why did you have your daughter vaccinated, is very reassuring for us because we went into this not really knowing. Nobody had ever done this before. Nobody had ever done HPV vaccination in developing countries. What would they think? What would they say? Et cetera. Before we started the vaccination program, we actually asked parents, what information do you need to make a decision? And how do you think we should deliver the vaccine? I mean, it's a pretty simple question. What would you want? It's almost like consumer research, right? You have a new product. You're going to, like Burger King's going to put a new burger on the menu. They always do that customer research ahead of time. If I offered it with 2 slices of bacon instead of 3 slices of bacon, what do you think? Like, do that market research in advance and then introduce the product. So that's kind of what we did in these countries. We asked the parents, what do you need? How should we deliver it? And what's confirming for us is the kinds of things they said, these I've give some examples in blue, are the things that we then heard after the program. I want it to be endorsed by the government. I want you to tell me it's safe. I think vaccines are good for health. Make sure you answer my questions. These are the kinds of things parents wanted in advance. And so to have them say to us after we vaccinated, why did you get vaccinated? And say, well, I got vaccinated because you answered my questions. That was very confirmatory for us. Here's another way of looking at this issue of how parents make decisions. We looked at our data and we kind of separated it into whether you got information like a pamphlet. These are really popular. You probably go to the clinic and you get like a little brochure about how to do whatever, just gives you little health messages and tells you like the safe sex pamphlets and that kind of stuff. So we gave a lot of those out. I mean, hundreds of thousands of these things distributed all over Kingdom Come. And then we also had sessions where health workers or teachers would just talk to parents. Like, parents could come to like a PTA meeting at the school and get just like a little bit of information and have their questions answered. So between those two things, kind of what works? In fact, it's the talking that works. When you ask parents what's more important, if you look at these things, speaking to somebody that they trust versus not speaking to somebody at all about what your decision is going to be, these vaccination uptake rates are quite remarkable. 60% between 90%. So it makes quite a difference. And that's irrespective of whether you get any of this written leaflets about prevention. The prevention leaflets really didn't do anything. It's really about who you talk to. Well, it kind of makes sense, right? It's that human connection, that personal relationship. Think about big decisions you've made in your life. Have you made them in a vacuum? You're just sitting there in your head? No, you're probably talking to people that you trust, your friends, your parents, other relatives, people that you have a relationship with about that decision. This decision is very important for parents. It's a no-brainer, but nobody had ever done this before. So can you deliver it out to the community? Well, I showed you the numbers. 90% of people are getting 3 doses. So obviously the health workers are able to get it there. But which of these programs is working well? Clinics, schools, outreach, what do you do? What makes it work? Well, here's a few of the factors that make it work. Do your homework. Prepare. I mean, it seems a little bit obvious that in order for a new health intervention to be successful, you would have to do some planning. But you'd be surprised how many people don't plan for things. It just sort of gets dumped on the health system and they're told, make it happen, without any resources, without any management, without any direction. But what we found for HPV vaccine, actually, if you do good planning, lots of things fall into place. And if you do that planning, like if you're going to go to the school, you have to be careful. Don't go when they're given exams. Don't go when the kids are actually not at school. Don't go when the teacher's busy. You know, those very simple, obvious things. But if you don't plan for them, they don't work well. Some of the struggles, there were struggles, are down here in red. It is intensive. It's an effort. It's a lot of work to do this detailed planning to get things to run right. So that can cause problems, right? It disrupts the health system. It disrupts your regular work that you're doing that day. Just imagine somebody giving you another paper assignment to do. And you're like, well, wait a minute. I've got all these other assignments I need to do. So it's that kind of disruption that's also problematic for these areas. We had a hard time finding girls in Uganda who were of the age that we were looking for. We wanted to vaccinate 10-year-old girls. But surprisingly, they don't know their age. You'd think, oh, don't you know your birthday? They don't. Well, why don't they know their birthday? They don't celebrate their birthdays. I didn't know that. I've been working in Uganda 4 years and I didn't know that. They just don't celebrate their birthday. So a lot of people don't know when they were born. They might know the year. They might know the season. They might know around an event like, oh, yeah, the big flood 12 years ago. I had my second daughter or whatever like that. But the date, like January the 13th, 2001, can't come up with it. So we vaccinated a lot of girls in Uganda, but when we went back to try to verify their age, most of them were 11 or 12 or 13. They weren't 10 because people really didn't know how old they were. Important lesson. So can you pay for it? I talked about vaccine price earlier, but what I was talking about was vaccine price. Literally, just the price of the vaccine. That's it. It's $5 or $100 or somewhere in between. But there's other costs involved for these countries. You actually have to mobilize the personnel, the human resources to go out to deliver the vaccine. So if a nurse is sitting in the health center doing her regular job, and then she has to leave that health center to go to the school, there's a system in place in almost every single one of these countries where you pay her a little bit extra to be able to do that activity. So you have to come up with that money. That's a part of the cost of the delivery of the vaccine. All of this sensitization, this community awareness, health promotion campaign stuff, that's a new expense. You have to pay for it. You have to print out the leaflets that cost money, etc. So that's what these costs are here. Embedded in this colored chart, very colorful chart, are the costs of doing the vaccine implementation. And on average, it's about $1.50 to $2 every dose. And if you multiply that up, you have to give 3 doses of vaccine, it's sort of $4 to $6. But most of the cost, this pink stuff, is what we call startup. This is all that planning process in advance, which in fact, you only need to do once. The first year, when the program's getting launched. After that, actually, you don't have to invest that kind of resource anymore because now everybody knows it's going on, right? It becomes routine. It's just something that happens all the time. So these costs will go away after 1 or 2 years. Now, when you're looking at affordability, you have just this part of the bar. Like in Peru, this is like 80 cents. Add to that the 20 cents they can buy the vaccine for from Gavi. Now you have $1. That actually is affordable. Most new vaccine introductions, like we just did an analysis of rotavirus vaccine introduction in developing countries, and it costs about an extra $1 per vaccinated child to introduce that vaccine in a low-resource setting. And here, it's about $1 a dose. So fairly comparable. But there are failures. There's a lot of failures. I don't even want to talk about the Cambodia program because it's just so upsetting. It was a disaster. But these are some of the reasons why governments fail when they try to introduce this vaccine, whether it's on a small scale like Cambodia or Uganda where we were working, or a large scale like Rwanda or Lesotho who have done national programs. If you don't have the government 100% behind you, and not just behind you, but actually in front, like the Minister of Health on the television, in the papers, saying, this is good for you. This is supported by the government. This is for the health of your child. If you don't have that endorsement, these programs largely were not very successful. Because, as I mentioned before, people really trust these systems. It's important for them that they have that validation that this is something that the Ministry of Health, I mean, we look at our politicians and our elected officials with a little bit of skepticism, and they do too, but when it comes to health, it's quite unique. They're largely respected, and the advice that's given from a health perspective is largely respected. So it's critically important. And you can't, with the parents especially, you cannot avoid talking about side effects and safety. You have to. Just be out there. If there's going to be side effects, tell them. I mean, I did. I remember going to a vaccination session in Vietnam, and there was one girl who was just mortified. I mean, all of her classmates were teasing her. They were like saying, it's whatever, you're a baby, grow up, it's fine, blah, blah, blah. But she was terrified. She was terrified of the pain. Nobody would tell her it hurt. So I just said, it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. But you know what? It's going to last like 3 seconds, like a pinch. And then you'll be fine. Just that reassurance for her was important. And the same thing with parents and side effects. It's not that they don't think it should be side effect free. That's not the point. The point is they just need the reassurance. There could be some things that would happen. These are the things that may happen. We're watching out for them. And if they do, we have the medicines and the supplies here to take care of your child if it does happen. They just need the reassurance. There's a lot of logistics involved in coordinating these vaccination programs that are quite unique in a developing country setting. Imagine, where's some place in the boondocks of California? Like you're out, there really isn't boondocks in California, is there? You can kind of get everywhere by road, can't you? But let's just say you're going out like Death Valley, there's a good example. I mean, you're in the middle of nowhere, right? These places, they're in the middle of nowhere. The logistics of just mobilizing the health worker, getting her out of the post to the school that's in the middle of nowhere, very complicated. And if you can't get that sort of sorted from the beginning, the program will really be a disaster. I've already talked about Uganda and people not knowing their birth dates, so just be aware of that. And then also the interesting thing about the extra work, it was extra work. Let's just be clear. This is a big effort for people to do. But it was temporary. And almost every single nurse we interviewed said this. Oh my God, it was extra work. But the benefit was worth it. It interrupted my whole day that day, 3 times a year. There's 230 working days for these nurses in the year. So 3 times over the entire year, their apple cart was upset. They were okay with that because of the benefit. This will protect these girls from cervical cancer in the future, and that was a very powerful message. What did we learn? Well, it's obvious you can get them. Great. You can get parents to say yes. Great. Here's some lessons for the U.S. How do you get parents to say yes? You actually deliver the message by people that they trust. What's interesting is I see studies all the time about pediatricians in the U.S. not recommending HPV vaccine because they themselves don't think it's a good idea. And since parents largely trust their pediatrician, if their pediatrician doesn't recommend it, they're going to say no. This whole issue of trust is really important, whether it's in developed or developing country context. And then you can find these girls. It's great. They're attending school. Lots of people are there. You can kind of, it's an economies of scale thing, right? You've got 50 girls in school versus one girl coming to a health clinic, and the cost is the same. So value for money, spend that money sending the health worker to the school to vaccinate 50 girls rather than spend the money with the health worker at the clinic only vaccinating one. And I've already sort of honed this point again, the government endorsement issue. Absolutely 100% critical. You cannot run a vaccination program in a developing country without the government behind it. Period, the end. So what's next? So I showed you this map early on. Here's the countries that are doing it now nationally across the whole country. And then we had a few countries I showed you that are doing these pilots. A lot of pilots going on in Africa, not a lot of blue or grayish colors in terms of the implementation. But that's good news because there's a lot of experience now starting to be drawn in these very challenging sectors, right? These countries are very resource limited. But what's amazing about it is they're now starting to learn from each other. So I hold workshops, not in one country, like, you know, for Malawi, but rather I hold the workshop in Joburg, and Malawi comes, and Tanzania comes, and Zambia comes, and Botswana comes, and Kenya comes, Uganda comes, etc. So that their peers, these countries that have already implemented, are starting to now train or teach other countries who want to implement. So that sort of peer-to-peer, south-to-south learning is going on. And there's new national introductions coming up. This is something that's scaling up and scaling up quite quickly. So this year, Chile, Uruguay, Guyana, Botswana, South Africa, Uganda, and this is color-coded wrong, Uzbekistan, and this big one, Brazil, will all introduce nationally HPV vaccine. Largely 10 and 11-year-old girls is who they're targeting. So a tremendous amount of momentum is now starting to happen. And then there's future pilots, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Madagascar, Sierra Leone, Mali, they're all starting this year to do implementation. And then new ones, even more, just Senegal, Gambia, Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo, very, very challenging settings. But cervical cancer is a real killer of women in those countries. The benefit that they're going to gain, and they see the benefit they're going to gain, which is why they want to get experience in doing implementation. What is the ultimate goal of all this? The ultimate goal is to prevent cervical cancer. And if we start today and scale up at the pace that we think will happen, based on that map I just showed you, probably 2 million future deaths will be averted in just in the next 15 years. Amazing amount of impact can happen with this vaccine in places that need it the most, places that have the fewest resources but the highest cost borne by their population by this terrible disease. 100% preventable disease. Thank you. So, we have a few minutes for questions. Lots. I'll start here and then work my way back that way. Ma'am.
How many strains, you mentioned the strains, does the vaccine cover all of the strains?
Ah, good question. So, the strains in the vaccine is different than the strains that are covered by the vaccine. So, what does that mean? So the strains in the vaccine, in the quadrivalent, there's two strains, 16 and 18, and 6 and 11, so four strains. In the bivalent, just 16 and 18. But new research has shown that actually the bivalent vaccine protects against other strains that are not in the vaccine but are phylogenetically related to those two types. So 31, 33, and 45 have high cross-reactivity in the bivalent vaccine was 16 and 18. They're along the same tree. I didn't show a phylogenetic tree for HPV viruses, but they're related to each other. And so you're getting some cross-neutralization that happens with these other types. So even though they're not in the vaccine, women are being protected from infections with those types from that vaccine. Other questions? This lady, oh, yep. Professor.
Oh, I have three questions.
Oh. Okay.
In the previous slide, you had immunization suspended.
Yes.
I don't know what happened.
Okay, I can tell you that.
And then in your second slide, you already thought of having cancer.
Yes, yes. Okay.
And the third question is about the recent news. Pakistan and Nigeria in particular, there are people who wanted to do a two-engine attack because other kinds of people would
okay.
Okay. And they're threatening public health workers. I don't know if you ever experienced that kind of resistance based on where you're from, for
yeah.
example.
Yeah, okay. So the first question, vaccine suspensions. So there's three countries that actually suspended vaccinations: Peru, Romania, and Fiji. So Fiji did a national launch that was absolutely disastrous for lots of reasons that are too detailed to go into here. But they learned from that. They actually went back to the drawing board and spent 3 years carefully planning the reintroduction of the vaccine, which happened in 2012. So Fiji reinstated vaccinations, and it's now going well, thank goodness. Peru suspended because the new Minister of Health wanted to review all new vaccine introductions to make sure that the decisions were made properly from the prior administrations. Remember the president, they had to change of elections, the politics of that, et cetera. So they reviewed all of those new vaccine introductions, suspended all of them. They suspended rotavirus and pneumococcal virus vaccine and HPV. So it wasn't singled out because it's HPV. But the reviews the last one that was completed was the one for HPV, and they've now reinstated HPV on the national immunization schedule, and they'll restart vaccinations this year. And then Romania suspended the vaccine because they had a very powerful anti-vaccine lobby that got a hold of all this horrible anti-vaccine literature on the internet about Gardasil killing girls and that kind of stuff, and they have not started again at all. So it's a real difficult problem, actually, in the former Soviet republics. The WHO has been working quite intensively with many of those countries that are starting to introduce this vaccine, and they have horrible anti-vaccination problems there with Romania. So it's not, and I have not yet heard that it's going to start again. The screening slide about HPV test. What that is right now women get a pap smear. It's really kind of uncomfortable, isn't it? You get a cervical swab and they put it on a lab, but it's actually not a great test. It's only about 50% sensitive. Great specificity, so if you're negative, you're negative. But if you're positive, you may not be positive. There's a lot of false positivity that comes out of pap smear. You can almost flip a coin and guess whether or not she is or isn't infected. That's how low the sensitivity is. But it works because you do it all the time. So eventually one of those is going to be right. But the consequence is we over-treat in the United States because we over-screen. What HPV DNA-based testing does, it actually tests for the DNA, the virus itself. So you could take a swab, test for the virus, and it's highly, highly sensitive, and it's also very specific. So in fact, you don't need to do it as frequently, because if you are negative on an HPV test, the likelihood that you'll go on and progress to cervical cancer is almost zero after 10 years of follow-up. And those studies have been recently done in Europe, and it's very clear. So the vaccine, in combination with HPV DNA testing, is going to change the face of cervical cancer screening as we know it. Pap smears in many European countries are actually going to be obsolete because they're not going to do them anymore. They're changing to a DNA-based testing screening program. They'll start at the age of 30 because cervical cancer takes a long time to develop between infection and actual cancer. So there's plenty of time to prevent. But if you have a negative HPV DNA test at age 30, you don't need to be tested again until age 40. And several countries are considering that as the way to go for the future. So that's on the screening side. Now remind me of the last one?
The attacks.
So the attacks in Nigeria and Pakistan are related to the polio workers. And there's lots of distress in certain sectors of those communities, mainly from a religious point of view, that's anti-vaccine, so all vaccines. So it's not just the polio workers. They're just on the front line right now. In places where we have been, we haven't had that, thank goodness, but it's a real concern. So governments do have to plan for that, which is why this sort of sensitization community awareness-raising exercise is super important to do in a developing country context, because you really do want to make sure that everybody gets the right information and you have the right people behind you giving that information, sort of the community leaders, the people that parents trust, et cetera. We did a lot of education in Uganda with the imams and the heads of the Muslim communities that were out in these rural districts, because they were quite influential in health decisions in those communities. And when they sort of are at mosque and give their verbal support, it made it so much easier for the vaccinators to do their work. Ma'am, I think you had a question, and then there was one here, and I think there was one back there.
Two completely separate questions. One first, probably more simply, is we were talking about the amount of
cost of media and the sensitization program, the awareness campaign, and the importance of government also doing that. So is the government usually responsible, and do you ever have resistance from them to pay for their own media campaign, but to go on TV and endorse the program?
So you want us to ask the second question, or should I just?
However you prefer.
I'll just take that one first then. So for the poorest countries, the Gavi Alliance, who buys the vaccine on behalf of poor countries, they also give an introduction grant with that. So they get a small pot of money to help them with all those startup expenses at the beginning. So governments will often use that additional money to pay for these sensitization programs. There's also other donors in country that they're getting bilateral aid from. So like you might have heard of the acronym USAID, it's the United States Agency for International Development. That's where our foreign overseas development assistance goes. USAID gives a lot of money to foreign governments related to health interventions. So those kinds of donations that come from other governments that place is getting, they will use those resources. But oftentimes, they can mobilize it within their own locally available finances, which is actually what happened in Peru. They actually wrote a budget. The EPI program wrote a budget, and then we submitted that to the Minister of Health, who endorsed it. And then the Minister of Health sent it to the Minister of Finance, who endorsed it. Then the Minister of Finance sent it to Parliament, and Parliament actually made a separate line item allocation for all the money that was required for Peru to introduce HPV vaccine, because they don't get donor funding for that kind of activity. So they were actually able to get a legislative action where new money is coming into the system rather than having to borrow from Peter to pay Paul kind of a scenario. Which is some. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but for the most part, they're able to mobilize those resources from multiple places. Yeah. And the second question?
I was also wondering if you've seen a relationship between the incidence of part of
Well, that's interesting. You know, I actually haven't seen any literature about HPV infection in places with FGM. Does everybody know what FGM stands for? It's female genital mutilation. And it's quite prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa, especially in the belt just right below the Sahel. So just that sort of area. So there are countries that are doing HPV vaccine that have that as a cultural artifact. So Niger, Mali are two good examples. And so far, I haven't heard anything from those countries of being resistance, those two things being linked. And it might be related to the messaging that happens. This vaccine, the message is really about cervical cancer prevention. The message is not STI prevention. So since the messages aren't wrapped into a sexual framework, that in some ways is kind of saving that conversation for a future point when it's more appropriate. And that might be then if you don't have sex involved, then it may not be close enough relationship to sort of the FGM as an event, because that usually happens around puberty, et cetera, so that those things get kind of tied up. Puberty and sex get messy in places, right? I mean, they're messy here, right? Any of you who are parents that have, you know, adolescent girls, you know what this is about. So it's even doubly messier in those contexts with those challenges. But right now, I haven't heard of anything like linking those two things. Yeah. Other questions? Sir, you had one, and then...
If you go for 100% coverage of the developing world scores of that age group, so you're talking about a few $100 million per year.
Yes.
So where would that money ultimately come from? So an NGO which depends on donations cannot raise hundreds of millions of dollars, I assume.
Yeah, that's true. They can't, which is why, in our experience, it's been these programs run better if they're run from the Ministry of Health. They're not if they're run from NGOs. Because it's the Ministry of Health that has more access to resources than anybody else, because they can leverage bilateral aid, they can leverage the Ministry of Finance, they can leverage international donors in ways that NGOs often can't. So from that framework, just from a financing framework, most of these programs will be better positioned financially if they're actually run from the Ministry of Health instead of from the NGO.
The Ministry of Health wouldn't pay for the girls in Brazil to be. The U.S. Ministry of Health would not pay for the girls in Brazil to be. They don't only mean the money flows.
Well, it just depends on how the government sorts itself out, right? So Brazil's development, overseas development assistance that they're getting from the United States is probably really small because Brazil is quite a rich country and they can sort of take care of that. But USAID gives gajillions of dollars to other countries in aggregate around the world. I mean, Uganda's, where I've been working, is a classic example. And those monies do have strings to them. The U.S. government funds some things and doesn't fund other things, or allows governments to use those funds in some ways and not in other ways. By and large, immunization programs are widely supported. So if this vaccine is added to the routine immunization program, whatever funds are coming to that program would be used or would be tapped to be able to introduce this vaccine, as it would any other vaccine, whether it's rotavirus or pneumococcal or soon-to-be malaria vaccine, etc. So it's very country-specific that way. Any more questions? I think we're at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, we might break for the question.
So how much time between the fourth, second, and third? I see those cards that we have to bring them back.
Oh, you mean the doses? The schedule, right. So if you're doing, according to licensure, in the package insert of the vaccine, for Cervarix, it's 0, 1, 6. What I mean is 0 is the first dose. 1 means 1 month after the first dose, and 6 means 6 months after the first dose, not 6 months after the second dose. So 0, 1, 6. And then for Gardasil, it's 0, 2, 6. But not everybody abides by that schedule. There's different schedules being operated in different places. Mexico does 0, 6, 60. So first dose, 6 months later, second dose, 60 months after the first dose, which is, do your math quickly, 5 years. After the first dose, third dose. Chile does 0, 12, only two doses. South Africa does two doses as well. Switzerland does two doses, 0, 6. The UK and US, they follow the package insert recommendations. Most of it's about 0, 2, 6, but frankly, you're all busy people. You don't have time to. Most people are like 0, 4, 9, 0, 3, 7. You know, it's sporadic in terms of the timing. But in fact, the efficacy data, all three doses within a year is all you need. Well, actually, two doses within the year is all you need. But right now, the current licensure is three doses within 12 months. Okay, I think that's all we have. Thank you guys for staying, for your attention.